Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your host for this weekend's edition. On this show, first half of this show, we're going to be talking a lot about the equity markets and some of the, let's call them, newer trends that could have been established at the very beginning of this month. Also, a big focus going to be on the interest rate environment as we are broadly seeing higher rates in the U.S. We're kicking off this show with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors, that is read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail and individual side, check out the In the Know Trader website, which I will link to within our weekend show posting. This has three products, a monthly report called the 7-Eleven, where Rick picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs, with the goal to beat the S&P, a weekly report called the Tactical Trader Report, and a daily report called the Daily Tip Sheet. That was started just this year. Rick, it's always great having you on the show because we do go around a wide number of markets and you share with us what you're seeing in each of these markets, starting off broadly with U.S. equity markets, ending the week on a little bit of their back foot, but hey, all-time highs were hit mid this week again in the S&P and Dow. But Rick, the big question being, are these markets overextended in your eyes?
Thanks for having me, Corey and Shad. And to answer the question, sure they are. Now, the reality is you could have asked me that a month or two ago and I would have said the same thing. Sure, they're extended. You've moved up something like, I don't know, at the peak, 23% or so, 24%, maybe even more. Actually, it may even be close to a bit more off of that October low in a straight moonshot. I think a lot of what we're seeing in the profit taking today is part of, I'll say, a smattering of reasons why we should see a pullback. The CPI number early this week was hot, and yet the market leapt forward and actually marked a new all-time high close that day. Not an intraday high, but a new all-time high close on Tuesday. Then you had PPI yesterday, and it was a very hot number, and it took the market a little time to even decide to sell off, but it finally did, although somewhat late in the session, you got a decent bounce, and you know, the S&P closed mid-range on the day, which, you know, was showing just a tremendous amount of pent-up demand for stocks that you know, you'd see that on a day that should have obviously been a take profit day and a decent down day, given how much the market's moved up in the last several months. Today, we're getting some follow through as interest rates have moved higher. You've got the dollar up, you've got interest rates up. And if you think about where the U.S. 10-year, you know, today we're at about 4.31% with a high of 4.32%. A week ago, week and a half ago at most, I think it was actually even this week, we were at like 4.06. So you're talking about 25 basis point move higher in for stocks to deal with that has puts rates near the upper end of this year's range. 4.35, 4.36 or so is the high this year. You know, think back to January 1st. The street was incredibly bearish bonds, thinking that rates were going to collapse this year. To start the year, I think we were, I don't know, maybe 3.86, something in that neighborhood. I think one day this year, by a fraction of one basis point, yields closed lower on the year. For one fraction of one basis point on one day. The street could not have been more wrong about the direction of rates. And yet, here's the market, the stock market, up on, we're virtually on all-time highs. So something dramatically has shifted, besides the fact that rates have gone higher, something dramatically shifted on the equity investor side. And to me, what that is an acceptance that rates are going to be what the Fed has told us constantly, but people didn't want to believe, rates will be higher for longer. And this is proving so. Yet here we are on essentially right near all-time highs. For that to be, it has to mean that investors have shifted their psychology on being able to, at least when it comes to stock investing, accept higher rates. And in an environment where things have changed so quickly since October, and the perception being that the Fed was going to cut multiple times this year. Well, I looked, I think it was either yesterday or the day before, what was built in seven rate cuts in January is down to 4 to 5. Fed fund futures traders had priced in over a 99% chance that the Fed will not lower rates at next week's meeting. And the first time they've got targeted that they're fairly sure there will be a cut is in June. And as I said, they've got 4 to 5 cuts built in, not including if anything has shifted in the last 24 hours, because, again, I didn't look at it today, or I think it was the day before yesterday that I had looked. That means that all this belief that lower rates were going to fuel the stock market is no longer part of the equation. So the demand for stocks is coming simply on the belief that at some point the Fed is going to not only stop raising rates, but lower. I think we're all pretty much in agreement that they're not going to raise any longer. But when and if they actually cut, and I think the last time we spoke, guys, I said to you, I don't think they probably cut until the fall. So I'm not necessarily in the camp that they're going to cut anytime in the next couple of meetings, the way the market is still pricing that they will. And let me tell you, 4.3% compared to being under 3.9 to start the year has absolutely decimated fixed income portfolio investors who had bet heavily that rates were going to fall. They are the ones sitting in the doghouse right now and will have very difficult years and a very difficult time answering to investors how they so got that wrong. And that's a big part of what's going on now. So with the market coming off what it is today and the S&P is down as we talk about 35 points or so, it's off the low of the day, but it's down and it should be down given the fact that we've got 4.3% rates. And this week also there was a, I think it was TD Ameritrade, which is about to be Schwab, story out today that there were record inflows this week into stock funds. And that to me is almost perfect where we may finally get some pullback in the market. You're seeing record inflows coming from the public. That makes a lot of sense to me, and more the reason why we certainly could get a pullback that's more than the 2% or so that we've gotten since October in the S&P. I mean, you really can't get more than a 2 to 3% pull down. I think now, we could finally see a little bit more than what we've seen in the past.
Well, Rick, just along that line of thinking, a lot of articles came out midweek once people had started digesting the higher CPI and then again the higher PPI a couple days ago. I think a lot of people are looking at it the same way you just outlined it. Hey, we're not going to get as many cuts this year from the Fed as we initially anticipated, with inflation not just being stickier, but even bouncing higher a little bit. Is it possible that there was something else besides the Fed rate cut expectation that's been driving these markets higher, maybe just strict momentum or technical breakouts, and now that's reached an apex and we may get that bigger corrective move that you just mentioned? Because everybody's putting 100% of this on the Fed expectations, but we've had a couple analysts come on the show and say, I don't think it's just that. I think there's other things afoot. What do you make of the reasons behind why we've seen such a blistering rally since October all the way through present?
Well, there's several things here, Chad. First off, there was so much buying done fourth quarter last year that to me, it eliminates what was more reasonably could have come this year when and if we get those rate cuts. So the market's a forward-looking discounting mechanism. The fact that the street shifted its psychology in fourth quarter last year to the fact that the Fed was done raising rates and will in fact lower rates multiple times this year is where all that buying came in from. And it followed through into the beginning of this year. Now I think you're starting to see more saner, cooler heads prevail in realizing, A, rates are going to stay up higher for longer. B, the economy is humming along, even with higher rates. But it puts a dilemma in for Chair Powell of the Fed in how to handle the fact that we just got a pretty big uptick in inflation numbers, especially on the PPI side, and that his long-stated goal of getting to 2% inflation is going, he's going to have a hard time actually making that happen. And I think what could easily happen over the next several weeks is that you see some profit taking off of this run. You get a more balanced point of view on the fact that rates are going to stay elevated. I mean, you've got to get under 4% in the 10-year and stay under 4% to change at all the psychology of rates higher for longer at this point. And the fact that we just sold down to 4.05 and a week later you're at 4.31 says to me a lot about what's going on in the market and the fact that even though you have a strong economy and even though stocks can generally do well in a strong economy, the differential in the rate environment relative to what we've seen for years and the fact that we're up above 4% in the face of what virtually every portfolio manager expected for this year means that there's a lot of different pieces of the puzzle coming into play right now that were not anticipated by many people in the street. And you throw into the mix the still very bifurcated market between the haves and the have-nots. And what I'm referring to is essentially the super-duper large-cap names versus the average name. An equal-weighted S&P doesn't look anything like what the cap-weighted S&P looks like. And even though we're getting a broadening out of market participation, the fact that just a handful of names is so dominant in the pricing of the S&P, to look at the S&P and to judge the market based upon a cap-weighted, so dominated behemoth group of 10 stocks, give or take, that really control the pricing of the S&P, you're looking at almost false information by looking at the S&P and saying, oh, look how good the U.S. stock market is. Because it's dominated by a few names. Take out that Mag 7 or whatever you want to call the top 10, 12 names, and you have a very, very different looking chart than what the, you know, the spiders look like.
Yeah, that's a very good point there, Rick. Something that we have heard, even though breadth has widened out a little bit, still very much dominated by large cap stocks. But this is still the environment where money is still going into the market, just in a concentrated sense. What does this tell you about where money could flow if we do get this pullback? If the large caps do start to struggle a little bit on less rate cut optimism, where does money move?
I think, look, there's so much talk about the Russell 2000 was supposed to have a spectacular year this year. And I've told my clients to start probably close to 2 months ago, it is, you know, where I said, start considering putting money into small caps. But I made a very clear caveat to that statement that small caps will work if, and if was in capital letters, if rates can sell off. So if you got a decline in rates, if rates were going to stay up, you're going to have a very hard time seeing Russell 2000 names do well if rates are 4.25% and above. Even 4% and above is going to stymie that rally. So if the mega caps start to see some real profit taking, and we've certainly seen that over the last few weeks, if Russell is going to have a hard time moving higher, then what you're talking about is going down the cap scale from the huge names in the S&P to the non-huge names, right? So go past the first 25 names, maybe even past the first 50 weighted names. So the other 450 names in the S&P should get relative bids to the mega caps and probably mid cap. But you can't go, I think it's, you know, small is going to have a real hard time if rates stay up like this. So it's hard for me to tell people at this point that you really want to put money into Russell 2000 names if there's a chance that 10-year is going to get to 4.4 to 4.7. May not go back to the 5% we saw last year. But if we keep, as long as we stay above 4 to 4.25, Russell 2000 names are going to struggle. So if you got to think about where are you going to put your money in stocks, I think you have to go down the cap curve, get away from the first few, you know, dozen names that are the heavyweights in the S&P, and start going more towards what we would say is the, quote, average stock.
Okay, Rick. So maybe not as bullish on the small caps, but maybe some of the mid caps and some of the lower end of the larger caps, but not the very high end of the mega caps. Another sector that has been doing better than I think a lot of people expected is actually the commodities the last couple of weeks. If you look at it, we've seen oil break above 80. It's at 81 and some change at the time of this recording. We've seen gold break out, I think surprising some folks that it was breaking out in tandem with everything else. We've seen silver back above 25. It's above 25.40 at the time of this recording. We've seen copper back above $4 now. It's at 4.12 at the time of this recording. So a lot of the commodities are getting a lift. Does that tie in with the higher inflation thesis?
It's funny because it's not much more than, I think, 2 weeks ago, I read two different articles about commodity prices were sagging and that people should not be concerned about commodity prices. If anything, they're indicating the opposite and they are disinflationary and you're not going to get a surge. Now, since then, oil, as you said, has broken over 80. Gold has made new all-time highs. Cocoa is on a 40-year high. And why do I care about cocoa? Well, I eat chocolate every single day without fail. So I was in Costco 2 weeks ago, and I loaded up on, they have, God bless Costco, they have Godiva choice, individually wrapped Godiva dark chocolate hearts were on sale for something like $8 for almost a pound bag. Now you walk into a Godiva store and you're paying, I don't know what, $25 for a pound. These are pre, you know, packaged. So what did I do? I bought 4 packages. Mike, come home. My wife says, what are you doing? I said, honey, these things are going to be double the price in a few months. The price of cocoa is out of control, and it is going to finally trickle down, and we won't be able to see these things for this price. And considering I eat, you know, chocolate every day, might as well grab it now. And you are still seeing the grains have been certainly depressed, but you are going to see still higher food prices. Notice, regardless if commodity prices go down, does the price of a loaf of bread in the supermarket ever go down? No. It will only go higher over time due to inflation. And when the underlying commodity ends up costing more, then the manufacturers have no problem telling us our cost is higher and we have to pass that along. Food prices will continue to slowly move up. Just now I had lunch with a few guys in the neighborhood. And they were talking about that the price of onions is double what it was a year ago. I mean, basic things in your home are costing much more. Today, oil's fairly flat, but heating oil's up, gasoline is up. The only thing that's been down and steadily down, thank God, has been natural gas. So for those who heat their homes and in the summer cool their homes with natural gas, this year should be a good year. You know, net gas is $1.65. 2 years ago, at the height of right after the Russia's invasion of Ukraine, gas was over $10. It's now well less than $2. So there's the one place that I say as a consumer, you did better. But the price of commodities has started moving higher. And if you look, you know, CRB index is heavily weighted on the energy side. So crude oil is its biggest component. Goldman Sachs commodity index, a little more fairly balanced. But you've started to see this moving up again. And not that commodity prices get materially affected by the U.S. rate market, but from a psychological point of view, when you see rates moving up, it often ends up pulling commodities with them.
Rick, make more sense of this for me, please. Tugging on that last point there, because look, the inflation data that we saw this week was data from February, and the commodities breakout that we've seen has mostly come this month. So one, would you expect that higher commodities prices to filter into that inflation data now moving forward? And in terms of higher rates, especially in terms of precious metals, don't higher rates usually mean pressure on the precious metals prices?
Yes. Higher rates are not typically good for gold because gold gives you no dividend, no interest. You know, the only way you make money owning gold is to sell it at a higher price than you bought it for. Whereas you could buy a stock that, let's say, a nice dividend paying stock, even if the stock's flat over a couple of years, you're making money from the dividend. You don't get that in gold. So higher rates is a negative for owners of gold and a reason why many people stop and think before they buy gold because they look at the interest rate environment. I have a CD that's actually maturing. It's within the next 2 or 3 days. And this morning I started shopping around again for, you know, what are CD rates now? And most banks, forget the money center banks. Anybody who banks at a money center bank now is just plain foolish. There's no reason to be dealing with Bank of America, Chase, and the like, paying you, you know, 2-3 basis points in interest when you can actually get 5% virtually anywhere else. I looked at what the rates are, and you can get a 1 year anywhere from about 5.1 to as high as I saw 5.5% for a 9-month CD. That's real money now. You know, on 100 grand, a 5%, you're talking about $5,000 in interest. If your money's sitting in a Chase or a Bank of America, you're basically simply walking away from $5,000 for every $100,000 you had in the bank. That's real money. That's also what gold traders need to think about when they invest in gold, because they're pulling money out of what now gets you, even in a money market, you can get 5%. I have my money in banks. I've shifted everything out of the money center banks, and I can get 5% just on a savings account. So when you invest in gold, you have to think about, sure, it's a hedge against inflation, da 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 da. You also have to think about, I'm taking money out of the bank in order to invest in a particular product. If it's gold, you're giving up, well, in anything now, you're giving up, let's say, 5% in the bank. So you need to kind of think, can I make more than 5% on this investment? Because that's, you need that just to break even. At 2,100 plus in gold, if you're talking about 5%, you're talking about over $100 of interest that you're passing up by buying an ounce of gold. You have to think about that as an investor. And higher rates here are going to theoretically put a lid on how quickly and how much gold could rally. Now, yes, it got a breakout. It broke out to new all-time highs. And I bought some gold a week ago, and I want to see it hold up because Corey, you and I had a conversation, I don't know, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. I don't remember exactly when it was, but when gold had that false breakdown beneath 1650. And it looked as if gold was going to really fall apart. And that was the low of the move that set up this whole move higher now to new all-time highs. If you're a gold bug, you got to see, let's call it, gold should not now again trade beneath $2,000 an ounce. In theory, it probably shouldn't trade beneath 2050, but it'll give it a, you know, a little fudge room. But gold could easily get to $2,400 in the next year simply on the momentum of the breakout. But that's not going to happen if rates go to 4.5% and 4.75%. So it's all parts of, you know, piece of the puzzle when you're looking at the CRB and you're saying things are moving up and oil's moving up and gold's moving up. Yes. But when it comes to gold specifically, you have to look at the factors that affect gold, the U.S. dollar, the direction of the U.S. dollar and the interest rates being the most important. And what's the alternative? And if you can guarantee yourself a 5% return in the bank right now, which you can you guarantee yourself a 5% return in gold? So you got to make, you know, over, as I said, over $100 in gold in the next year in order for it to make sense to buy gold. And each individual has to make that determination if that seems likely, and to what degree do they want to pull money out of the bank into something that has no yield on it other than other people paying higher than you in order to force the price higher. And then will you be savvy enough to also sell out before prices come down, if that's what, you know, ends up happening?
Well, Rick, just a quick follow-up on that, because there were a lot of people that were buying gold last year in the 1900s or 2000, even at Costco, along with the chocolate. And it has made more than a 5% move, so they have kept pace with the 5% that they would have made in a money market fund. The question is, can it keep going? Just from a technical basis, because I know you also look at technical analysis, when you see something like gold, we've had people on that are technicians, Rick, that talk about the large cup and handle pattern that started back in 2011. You know, the other side of the cup was 2020. It bounced around, made a handle for a couple of years, keep trying to break above 2000. When you see such a large base like that and it breaks out, you mentioned it could get to 2400, but that higher interest rates would be a, you know, a headwind to it. From a technical basis, couldn't it break up to 2400, 2500, the extension of that pattern? And wouldn't that be a pretty good bet on the gold market? Or do you think that the interest rates would swamp the technical pattern?
You have to look at both and think about, is gold an investment or is it a trade? If it's trade, are you savvy enough to be able to figure out when to buy it in relation to what's happening in rates? I've owned gold for many years, and I'm fortunate too because I also have access to one of the largest mutual fund, gold mutual fund portfolio managers in the world. And I mean, I've owned gold way, well before I had a relationship with that gentleman, but you know, he is mega bullish on gold, actually more specifically gold stocks, because in his mind, they are terribly undervalued relative to the price of bullion. And he sees huge opportunity in owning, you know, gold miner names. So let's, whether you want to look at it as the GDX or the GDXJ, which are the junior miners, you know, he sees huge potential for these. Now, I think part of gold's rally, more from a psychological point of view than anything else, is what's happened in Bitcoin. The fact that Bitcoin has surged over, you know, last summer Bitcoin was 25,000, and now it's, well, today it's about, I don't know, 68,000, but it was in the 70s, well, even in the last 48 hours. Now, I had argued with you earlier, 6 months to a year ago, that the rise in Bitcoin was taking money away from those who might have put it into gold and chose, you know, an alternative asset to put it in, but one that in also in to some degree in theory is a hedge against whether it's inflation. You know, you could look at crypto as also a hedge just against the whole monetary system, but it certainly hurt gold's prospects. Because money that could have gone into the gold market ended up going into crypto. And clearly the return in crypto has been far better than the return in gold. You know, I'm a traditionalist. I have a tiny, tiny position in Bitcoin. And when I say tiny, it is a small fraction of 1% of my portfolio. It's virtually nothing. And sure, it's doing fine, but I grew up in an era. I'm a child of the 1960s. You know, to me, I've always thought of gold as being something that I want to have as a part of my portfolio. It has continuously been. I added to it, as I said, about a week ago on the breakout above what had been the prior new all-time high that was made, I think, late November or early December. But I want to, before I really kind of put in more, I want to see that this actually is going to last and gets follow-through buying. And you look at what gold has done this week. It's down on the week. And, you know, you're not really seeing much follow-through at all. Now, it's early in the whole scheme of things. But if this is a real breakout before I put more money into it, I need to see that it actually is going to even stay above what was that high just from a couple months ago. And we're already kind of playing with that. That was, I think, what, 21.52 in front month futures? I mean, look, I'll tell you. Yeah, 21.52 was that early December high. So right now, you know, gold's kind of in the low 21.60s. I can live with the pullback here, but I don't really want to see gold even get to 20.50. So I can't tell you that I'm a confirmed bull. I'm playing enough, added some, but I'm not throwing a lot more money into gold right now. Not with interest rates doing what they've done.
All right. Interesting call there, Rick. And you know what? You can make the argument that at least it is consolidating above those highs. But as you said, it's playing with them a little bit. Can I get a little bit more information on your view on the gold miners? You alluded to it back there, but the GDX chart, if we just look at that, is such a different chart than gold's chart. Longer term chart, you can make the argument that it still hasn't really broken out of this multi-year downtrend, but it is well off of its lows of 2022. Back in the kind of late Q2, Q3 there. So what do you see in a chart like GDX?
Look, we've got a double bottoms from the October low in GDX occurred right around the same time stocks made their bottom. We then sold down to that same level in February, in the middle of February, and then got a bounce, and then even late February. So you've got a good, and now it's bounced from, let's call it, in and around 26 to up to near 30. So percentage-wise, very, you know, that's 12% or so rally, very solid rally. But this thing isn't close to being near highs. The all-time high in the GDX is back in 2011, north of 65. This is trading less than half of that. And that's why I at least understand the perspective of why this particular gold fund manager says, you know, gold miners are so cheap relative to the underlying commodity. They are, but this still has plenty of technical resistance at multiple levels. First, I put near kind of the 36 neighborhood. Then you're talking in 2022, you got to, I don't know, 41-ish, give or take, 41 and a half. And in 2020, when you had COVID and then the whole reaction to the stock market selling off and gold rallying, the GDX got up to 45, you know, and the, kind of a spike high up there. And then it sold down for a few years from middle 2020 to the low in 2022, GDX went from 45 down to 22. I mean, it cut itself in half. And yes, it's above there, but this has got a long list of, if you're talking about charting, you know, technical resistance areas that need to be hurdled in order to really change the picture here. And it just hasn't done it. I remember buying, I think it was maybe 2012 or 2013, the GDX in my own account at like 28. And here we are, you know, 10 years later, and we're still trading there. It's done nothing. Gold miners have not been a good investment at all. not only on their own, you've made nothing in 10 years, but certainly versus just having been in the S&P instead. You know, I always look at anytime somebody says, you know, I like this sector or you know, this commodity, what I always think of it in terms of either cash, what's cash yield me? And up until recently, it yielded you nothing. So it wasn't really a serious thing to look at. But I always look at it in terms of, well, the S&P. I mean, if you're going to make an investment, you think of, well, what's the market return? So few people ever beat the market that you still generally, to the average listener, to the average investor, you are far better off buying spiders and Qs, QQQ, which is the NASDAQ 100, instead of trying to pick where to be. You know, I make a living out of picking where to be and advising some of the biggest hedge funds in the world of where to be and when to be where they are. But for the average person, you're just better off, A, being invested for the long haul, and B, just picking the S&P and the Qs, you know, some passive indexes, instead of trying to be a hero. You know, for every NVIDIA you might have been lucky enough to have bought, there are also long names that have gone nowhere or gotten decimated. You know, a few years ago, marijuana stocks were as hot as could be. Tilray was trading 100 and, I don't know, 20. And what's it now? Single digits? Something like that? I mean, it's very hard for the average person to pick what's actually going to be real winners over time. You're just better off being invested in the market and using the passive indexes, the low-cost passive indexes, whether it's Spiders, VOO, which is Vanguard's S&P 500. You want to pay, you know, under 10 basis points in fees and just invest in the market as in a whole. Because, again, you put money in gold, that's fine. But look what happened if you put money in gold. Well, gold has made money in the last 10 years, but gold miners, if you played it on the equity side, you've made absolutely nothing in a period of time that the S&P has had a huge run higher. So generally, most people are just better off being in the market in one of the major passive indexes.
Yeah, Rick, it's a solid point. It's very few fund managers that can even beat the indexes, no matter what sector they're in. And there are sectors that have their moments in the sun where they shine. There have been times where the gold stocks or silver stocks rally, but they were very short-lived, and the S&P over time has definitely outpaced them. Now, I want to just circle back to one more time to the crypto verse, because those investors would argue that they have been beating the returns in the general markets lately. Now, granted, it's an insanely volatile space. It was crazy in 2017, and then it crashed by 80%, and then it was crazy a couple of years ago and crashed again. Now it's up in a big way. It's already rolled over by 8% just in the last couple of days, though. Do you think that the cryptos, in particular Bitcoin and Ethereum, the two leaders, can they keep outpacing the general markets, or are they actually trading as a leveraged play to the markets, because as the markets turned over, they just turned over in a bigger way?
Two ways to answer that. First off, specifically in something like Bitcoin, Bitcoin has limited supply. And if now that the SEC approved the 11 Bitcoin-related ETFs a month or two ago, if the brokerage firms and the strategists on Wall Street, seeing what Bitcoin has done over time and making new all-time highs, if they even recommend that the average person should put 1% of their money into Bitcoin, this thing still has a huge amount to go on the upside simply because of increased demand and no supply. Limited supply, and now very little supply, you know, on the market. You have huge inflows into these ETFs and not a lot of natural sellers. Because most of the people who buy Bitcoin buy it because they believe it's going to double or triple or go 10 times the price of where it is. No matter when they bought it, those who believe in this game and this story think it's going to go up 5-10x. So specifically something like Bitcoin, if there becomes more universal adaptation and belief that even if you don't believe in it conceptually, if you have a financial advisor say, look, put 1% of your money in there. It's a very small amount. If it goes to zero, it's not going to kill you. It's 1%. But if you have all these people buying 1% of their portfolio, then this thing still be given the limited supply, then Bitcoin specifically could still go well higher. I myself sold out of half my Bitcoin just, I don't know, 2 weeks ago or something at 57,000. And as soon as I sold out, I mean, shot to 67,000. I sold half of what I have for reasons of, you know, the models I use and where it was relative to, you know, former price or whatever. Obviously, in hindsight, not a good sale. I lived with it because that's what I do for a living. But I'm willing to hold on to, you know, the very small amount I have left. And, you know, do I hope it goes to $200,000? Sure. I couldn't care less either way, frankly, because it's such a tiny piece of my portfolio. And when a good friend of mine tells me, I've been telling you to buy it, Rick, I keep telling you to buy it. You're missing the point here. You know, that, the thing is, to me, it's no different than if you had, you know, were smart enough to have bought NVIDIA a year ago or 3 years ago, or Apple when it was trading for, you know, $7 and things. They're just, it's just one name in a big portfolio. And even though it would have been a home run if you were long Bitcoin from 10,000 and now it's, you know, near 70,000, it's just one name and a whole bunch of names that you're going to have. And I frankly couldn't care less that I, quote, missed it, or that I didn't have a lot more of my money in it. It's something I still can't wrap my head completely around. I don't think it's going to have the universal acceptance that the Bitcoin Kool-Aid drinkers believe. And is it a way to potentially make money on a speculative basis? Absolutely. But you also have to be savvy enough to know when to get out before this potential tulip mania falls apart. And it may or may not. I don't know. I don't know where Bitcoin will be in 5 years from now or 10 years from now, if it'll be, you know, 10 times the price it is now, or if it'll be virtually zero. I don't know. It's the type thing that I understand from the point of view of those who have drank the Kool-Aid on it. I understand why they have, but it's not my nature to go put 10% of all my investable funds into one name. Never do that, no matter what it is. So it's just one of many, many, many types of assets and securities you can invest in.
All right, Rick, we'll wrap it up here. Thank you for spending all this time with us and really focusing on some of the commodities as well, but also the cryptos and the markets. It's a pleasure having you on the show. We'll chat again next month. Again, if you want to follow along with Rick and all his moves in the markets, you need to check out the In the Know Trader website and the three products that he offers to more of the retail and individual traders. Rick, thank you so much for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, Corey and Chad. Thanks for having me.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.